Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance, go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Greetings, everyone, from Florida's Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I'm Jim Behnke, and this is the April 2nd, 2011 edition of Space Talk, brought to you by Space Florida, committed to expanding Florida's aerospace enterprise. Well, it is a perfect 72 degrees and sunny outside today here in Central Florida along Florida's Space Coast. And if you're listening in on the show today, I hope you're doing it on your back porch, in your patio, around the pool, out for a nice drive, sitting at the beach, anywhere but inside, buried in a den somewhere or in your bedroom. Get outside and enjoy that weather. And join us along as we talk about our space program today. You can join us, by the way, as always, in the conversation. Give us a call, 321-768-1240 is the phone number, star 1240 for AT&T wireless customers here on the Space Coast. It's a free phone call into the studio. If you're more comfortable with email, as always, our address is spacetalking@AOL.com, and that'll shoot you right in here to the screen right to my right, and we can find out what you're thinking and what your questions or comments are as we go along. Well, one of the goals of this program has always been to make sure that we stay focused on things beyond just what's happening in our backyard. And it's always amazing to me when I go searching for space news and follow along during the week that there is so much going on in space nowadays. It is just not a quiet time out there. So many things have happened this past week that it just shows you the width, the breadth, the deepness of the activity of what's happening. And let me tell you a few of those things, because I think, you know, even in the routine details of some of these things, I've found some interesting nuggets. And the first one, which I think is the greatest thing, was that this past Monday up at the International Space Station, the Japanese HTV cargo ship, that's their version of the Russian Progress vehicle. It's the Japanese version of the European Space Agency's ATV, the automated transfer vehicle. The Japanese calls theirs the HTV. And while the earthquake and all the disaster in Japan affected only slightly some of the activity on the space station and in this cargo ship, it did in fact detach from the station and programmed to re-enter and burn up in the atmosphere, as it did on Tuesday. And everything went well. What was interesting about the re-entry was that although there was no heat shield on the unmanned cargo ship carrying a bunch of garbage into the to burn up into the atmosphere, they did put a little package of sensors on the, I don't know if it was inside or on the side of the ship. I'm not really sure exactly where it was. But that did have a heat shield on it. And so what the idea was that as it re-entered the atmosphere, the little package of sensors collected data on the breakup of this cargo ship as it burned through the atmosphere. We don't have that kind of information. That kind of detail is just not out there. When we lost Columbia burning up on re-entry and you could get a lot of the pieces on the ground, you know, people go back and study some of that breakup, and indeed that was all part of the investigation. But in this case, this was almost a controlled experiment in a way, directly designed to record this information. And in fact, that recorder was recovered, and they're going off and looking at it. And of course, it's too early to tell what it's telling us. But the idea of putting this little sensor package on something reentering like that, through hypersonic reentry and burning up and recording the breakup of the spacecraft itself. Lots of possibilities for the future for spacecraft design, improving spacecraft design, understanding what parts could survive reentry. You know, again, public safety always, you know, always at the forefront of what they're thinking about. So that was interesting. Same time, basically Tuesday night at the Kennedy Space Center. By the way, the last set of solid rocket boosters they began stacking those in the Vehicle Assembly Building for Atlantis's flight next summer. So that was a milestone along the way here, the last set of boosters. And again, we keep talking about the last. Well, I think when we're talking about the Atlantis mission, we truly are talking about the last mission right now. Nothing scheduled to fly after that flight next summer. Wednesday, a very interesting thing happened down in French Guiana at the Kourou, at the Guyana spaceport near Kourou. An Ariane 5 rocket aborted its launch takeoff. And now the Ariane 5, you got a picture. If you don't know what it looks like, it's basically, it looks like a space shuttle, large giant external tank with two solid rocket boosters, and the payload goes on top of the tank. There's no side-mounted orbiter. It's just a upright rocket cargo carrier. And the way they do it is they count down to launch, very similar to the shuttle, and when they hit zero, then they start their liquid main engine, their main engine underneath their tank. And they fire that up for about 7 seconds and run all the tests. And if the tests all pass at that point, then they go ahead and light up the solid rocket boosters. Again, very similar to what we do here, except for that we start our space shuttle main engines, you know, about 6.6 seconds before liftoff. And then you can count down. And in the past, when we've aborted, you know, at the last second, you know, you can see like 2 seconds left on the clock or something like that. Well, in this case, they got within just seconds, a second or two, of committing to firing those boosters. The computers detected something wrong, and they shut down the main engine. Never been done before in an Ariane 5. In fact, it was the first time, reportedly, the first time since an Ariane 1 had the problem back in December of 1979. So you got to go way back to the beginning of their program to find that. So it was a very interesting, very unusual circumstance for the European Space Agency and for the Ariane space folks down in South America to experience this kind of a launch abort on the launch pad. And so, again, you know, the routine of space flight, it's not there. They've been launching Ariane 5s for a long time, and to have this thing come up, again, shows you that we're always learning something new. And again, they'll figure it out, and they'll fix it, and they'll fly when they feel that they're ready to fly. Closer to home here, speaking of main engines, Discovery's main engines were removed this past week. You know, Discovery had its final mission. It's officially retired right now. No plans to fly it again. The shuttle main engines coming out of the vehicle made me start thinking about when are they past, I guess, what you might call the point of no return. When are they past the point where, as they process Discovery, they remove something that once it's removed, it doesn't go back on again, and Discovery is committed to becoming a museum showpiece. I don't know when that time has come, if it maybe has already come or not. I know that, I mean, you think the main engines coming out would be something, but it's not. You can put the main engines back on. That's a routine, quote-unquote, procedure. I don't know when that time comes. In fact, if anybody's out there, NASA KSCPAO senior managers, if anybody wants to send a quick note to me at spacetalking@AOL.com, yeah, and let me know, or we'll investigate it during the week. When does Discovery hit the point of no return on its processing for flight? Let's see, what else? A minute to go here. Well, we're 10 days away from the announcement of when we think we are, of where the space shuttle orbiters are going to wind up. And like the NFL draft, I think I've got my picks ready to go. And maybe we'll save those for the end of the hour and keep you teased on that, my picks on where the shuttles are going to go. So when we return from this break here, we're going to be joined by John Logsdon. We're going to talk about President Kennedy. We're going to talk about President Kennedy's decision to go to the moon, what we can learn from that, a little bit of history, plus your comments and questions along the way as well. Space Talk sponsored by Space Florida. I'm Jim Bankey, and you are listening to WMMB.
Space Talk is back in a minute. Call Jim now at 768-1240 and star 1240 for AT&T wireless customers. with everything you need to know about America's space program, here is Jim Behnke.
And welcome back, everybody, to Space Talk, brought to you by Space Florida. I'm very excited today about our guest. My guest today is Dr. John Logsdon. He is Professor Emeritus of Political Science and International Affairs at the George Washington University's Elliott School of International Affairs, where he did teach for 38 years, recently retired, and founded during that time the school's Space Policy Institute, known world round. He is also the author of the book, John F. Kennedy and the Race to the Moon, which he was in town here at BCC in Cocoa last month to discuss during one of the monthly space lectures BCC offers. He is one of the few absolutely credible go-to guys when it comes to discussing our space program. And quite frankly, someday when I grow up, I do want to be just like him. John Logsdon, welcome to the show. It's good to talk to you again.
Good afternoon. Thanks for the nice words.
Well, you bet. So, you know, we've heard your voice. We've seen your face on just about every space history documentary. I think a lot of folks know about you. But before we get into the guts of the book and all that, let's talk about your background, John. Do you consider yourself a historian, a public policy guy, a space cadet? How did it all come together for you and to get you where you are today?
Well, my first degree was in physics in 1960. I wasn't very good at it and wasn't doing science, was kind of bored with the work I was doing after getting a bachelor's, and went back to graduate school in political science in the fall of 1962,
yeah,
with space happening all around me. So I think almost every paper in a political science program I wrote during my doctoral studies was on space topics. And then my dissertation turned out to be the first book called The Decision to Go to the Moon.
Right.
And that was published in 1970. It got me to the Kennedy Space Center on July the 16th, 1969, for the launch of Apollo 11. By that time, I was on my way to the faculty at GW, and kind of the rest is history.
Wow, that's incredible. And so you really, it was, I mean, talk about a niche topic at a time when nobody else was looking at things, and to be able to absorb and I'm sure collect documents and sources, firsthand accounts back then, I mean, that all informed really your whole career.
It did indeed. And there were a couple of people. I was strongly influenced by a professor who I never met named Vernon Van Dyke, who was at the University of Iowa, who wrote a book in 1964 called Power and Pride, that said those were the underlying rationales of the U.S. space program. He kind of set a role model that there was a legitimate political science slant to these things. So you asked me, I've written a lot of policy history, but I've never taken a formal history course.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the way I feel. I've been a journalist my whole life and only had a 2-credit course in college and didn't even get an A in it and still heard about it. Well, so you had this career. When did the media discover you, John? I mean, at some point, I remember going to school at Embry-Riddle back in the 80s, and it was like every PBS documentary had you and Marcia Smith in it.
Right, and Marcia's first job in Washington was as my assistant. So,
but worked out pretty good.
She doesn't talk about that very much. Well, there were two periods, Jim. One was having basically finished the decision to go to the moon by the time of Apollo 11. I got some media attention at that point, but that kind of went away as interest in the space program went away after the first few moon landings. And then, unfortunately, the media discovered me on January 26, is the right date, 1986, with the Challenger accident.
Right on the 28th, yeah.
Where, you know, within minutes of the accident, the phone started ringing, and I spent the next 36 hours doing probably 150 interviews.
What's this going to mean? How long are we going to fly again? What's
all
the
of
end
that.
Of everything?
Yeah.
And it's interesting that some of that operational stuff you would need to know and come to know is as much as just the policy and the back halls of Congress kind of stuff.
Yeah, but I try very hard not to fake technical knowledge that I don't have.
Yeah.
You know, having had a technical bachelor's degree means I can have a certain rather superficial understanding of the technical aspects of the program, but I try hard not to stay away from any kind of pronouncement on technical issues.
Well, and that's interesting to me, rocketing forward here, and again, we're going to get to the book in a minute, but to the Columbia disaster, and John was on the Columbia Accident Investigation Board, and John, I remember when that list came out of the investigators, there was a lot of us in the news media, I hadn't quite left journalism yet at that time, who cheered having you on there, that there would be this voice of reason and perspective on everything as the chaos of the investigation continued. I thought you brought some of that perspective, the historical, the policy, and of course, a very well-written report with your writing skills.
Well, let's see. First of all, the person to thank for all that was the chair of the board, Admiral Hal Gaiman.
Yeah.
Remember, the board went through two rounds of expansion. I was, along with Nobel Prize winner Doug Ostroff and Sally Ride, I was one of the last three added to the board.
Right.
I had had some interactions with Hal Gaiman on other projects before. And as the board got into its initial work in its first couple of weeks, it discovered that this was more than a technical accident and wanted somebody with a policy and historical perspective. And Gaiman raised my name with the other members of the board, and they agreed to bring me on. So it was one of the great experiences of my life working as part of that team.
Well, can you expand a little bit on that? Because, it must have just been fulfillment and I don't even know what words to use. Just blessings on your whole career. That says this was like the peak almost.
Well, it certainly was one of the peaks.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, you said well written report. We Gaiman also wanted to make sure that we had a report that the public and the Hill would read, and so we had a staff of professional writers who were largely responsible for the quality of the prose in the report. I mean, it was a 13-person board, and we had probably 175 people at one time or another supporting us. So it was a really intense effort between February the 1st and of 2003 and August, 23rd, when we released the report. Lots of interactions, really high-quality people, and I'd say a superb leader in Admiral Gaiman.
Well, and of course, I immediately want to start asking about vision for space exploration and shuttle and station and where we go from here, but I think it is a good time to go back now and look at the moon and the decision to go to the moon, because that certainly does today affect what we're doing. So let's go back to the book and talk about the book, first of all, itself. Did you describe it as a sort of a rewrite of your doctoral thesis, wasn't it?
Well, it's a rewrite and an expansion. The book that was published in 1970 called The Decision to Go to the Moon, published by MIT Press, was precisely that. It essentially stopped on May the 25th, 1961. We're
right.
Coming up on the 50th anniversary of Kennedy's announcement. As the years... And there weren't many documents available at that point. The Kennedy Library hadn't opened yet, et cetera. So there were three reasons I think I went back to look at again. The main one was to see what Kennedy did to translate a decision into a program. He was in the White House for 30 months after he announced his decision and stayed very much involved with the program. And I found that story had never been told, and I wanted to tell it. Then second, in the first book, I had totally missed a theme, which is that competing with the Russians was his second choice. He would rather have cooperated. He said so in his inaugural address. He said, "Let us explore the stars together." He made that proposal to Khrushchev in a summit meeting 10 days after announcing his decision to go to the moon. And it's remarkable that nobody in the space community remembers that on September the 20th, 1963, so 2 months before he was killed, he went before the UN and proposed a joint mission to the moon.
Yeah.
And I wanted to tell that story. And then finally, there were a lot more documents available, a lot more oral histories at the Kennedy Library, things like that. So it could be a richer narrative. And that's what's put together in this book.
Yeah, it's an absolutely outstanding book. When it's so many nuggets here through this whole thing, and I want to get into it here. We're about to get ready to take our break here, John. But what I want to get into here again is go back and talk about the sort of the myths that have grown up about President Kennedy and his involvement with the moon and what the reality was. And you know, part of that to me is my upbringing. You know, just as a kid in Minnesota, you know, I firmly believe, because I'm watching Star Trek on one channel and Apollo Moonwalks on the other, that it's all about space exploration and spirit of exploration and science and discovery. And the more and more I realized how political it was, I was personally disappointed in the whole thing. But I want to get into some of that with you here when we take a break. Stand by, John, by the way. Everyone
Will
else, we're going to pause, take our five-minute built-in hold, get caught up on the latest news, weather, and sports. And then when we return, we will talk more with Dr. John Logsdon about JFK, Project Apollo, maybe our future paths in space as well. Space Talk brought to you by Space Florida. I'm Jim Behnke. You're listening to WMMB.
And now back to Space Talk on WMMB.
Welcome back, everybody, to our second half of Space Talk on WMMB, brought to you by Space Florida, committed to expanding Florida's aerospace enterprise. Well, once again, joined by phone from, I'm assuming, the Washington, D.C. area, our longtime friend Dr. John Logsdon, author of the book John F. Kennedy and the Race to the Moon, which, by the way, you can purchase via a link on the Space Talk webpage. Just go to WMMBAM.com, keywords Space Talk, and later on this afternoon you'll see that option right there on the front of the page as we prepare the podcast and other weekly updates. And you'll be able to pick up that book and support Space Talk all at the same time. How convenient. John Logsdon, welcome back again to the show. Thanks for sticking with us.
No problem.
Good. Well, let's get into this now, the myths and facts of JFK and the decision. Again, as I was just saying at the bottom of the hour, you know, growing up in Minnesota and visiting Grandpa and Grandma Behnke down in the southern Fairmont, Minnesota, in the farm, and she'd have the Life magazines out. And to me, it was always about, you know, JFK touring the Cape and the pictures of John Glenn and him together, and then the pictures of Life covering the program. And it just seemed all so nice. And I'm watching Star Trek, and I'm thinking that space exploration and science and good of the country and, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And then as I get older, I start reading things by you and others, and my view of the universe is shattered.
Well,
that it would be so political.
It shouldn't be. I mean, first of all, this is money allocated through the political system. And so the fact that there's politics involved shouldn't surprise anybody.
Yeah, except for I didn't know about politics when I was a kid.
Well, lucky you.
Yeah.
but, I mean, Kennedy has been mythologized as a space visionary.
Right.
But he was far from him. He was a very pragmatic politician. He came to the conclusion in reaction to Yuri Gagarin's flight that the United States by default could not let the Soviet Union dominate this new area of human activity. He called it this new ocean. And I think it wasn't just romantic sailing he was talking about. He was talking about the control of the ocean that gave, for example, Great Britain a global empire. So he asked his advisors, find me a space program which promises dramatic results in which we could win. And they came back and said Moon was the answer to that. This was a Cold War decision made cold-bloodedly as something that was in the U.S. national interest.
And a major project in the sense that you mentioned it in the book, were there other ways we could show off our culture, our economic system, our politics, by curing cancer, just removing salt water, you know, from from the ocean, and all these other major things that you could spend so much money on. Why did it have to be the moon? And the defense aspects of it, the missile gap, the so-called missile gap, was a big part of this as well.
Well, I mean, you have to roll back these 50 years. We didn't really know what being able to operate in space might mean in military terms. And so the fact that the Soviet Union could put heavy payloads in space and we could not, I think, was an important consideration. Something that required building a big rocket that we could use for whatever purposes we chose at that point looked very attractive. Now, it turned out, fortunately, that there weren't a lot of militarily useful things that required putting heavy payload, very heavy payloads in space anyway. This was all part of the equation. And the image of the United States, I mean, Kennedy, after all, was a very image-conscious president. Mm-hmm. And the image of the United States was very important to him as currency in international politics. And the Soviet Union had defined the game, by saying that their space achievements were an indication of their strength, their power, their organizational ability, the superiority of the socialist form of organization.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Kennedy said, "Well, we can't change the rules of the game. I mean, we got to play their game."
Well, and it was not only to make us look good, feel good about us, but talk about the so-called third world, that we forget back then how many different nations were kind of watching both sides and seeing which side they might have to jump to follow.
Yeah, because countries were becoming independent at a rapid rate in the late 50s and early 60s and choosing what form of government, what form of social organization they were going to pursue. And to some, the communist form looked very attractive. So we were in a kind of zero-sum competition for influence on a global basis.
So now we know why JFK took us to the moon, and we know the reality of it. We understand it, I think. I don't know. Are there unanswered questions still that you have about the whole thing?
Well, I mean, we can never know what he was saying in informal conversations as he sat around with a drink at the end of the day. Historians really can't recreate everything that went on and every consideration. I quote Roger Launius, another eminent historian, that this may have been an element of Kennedy's quintessential masculinity,
mm-hmm.
which is a code word for minds bigger than yours.
Mm-hmm.
How much of his personal competitiveness and individual characteristics went into this decision, I think, is something that can never be answered.
You talk about after the decision was made and announced in May of 61, and we saw the Rice speech later in 62. We saw you talked about the United Nations speech in 63. In fact, a week before he was assassinated, he was here at the Cape looking at the rockets.
Yeah, that's the cover of my book,
which is a great, great picture, classic one from here at the Cape. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. And that really excited him because for the first time, the United States was going to launch a rocket more powerful than the Soviet R-7.
Yeah,
at its root, I think one of Kennedy's reasons was getting this powerful rocket
to get the heavy rocket so that we could, we're more powerful now than they are.
Well, at least we weren't at a disadvantage should there be any reason to have a powerful rocket.
Right, right. Well, so real quick, I'm going to cover a couple of things in another 3 minutes here, but the what-if game, John, if he had lived and continued on to a second term, would we have continued? Would we have made it by 70, or did it take his death to galvanize the whole goal part of this thing and make it happen?
I think he would have continued the program. He might have turned off the end of the decade clock. I mean, in 1963, as he was killed, the target was 1967.
Right.
It was the Apollo 1 fire that more than anything else that slipped the first landing to 69.
Sure.
I think he would have moved forward with the program if he had been able to live.
Now, moving ahead, what do we learn from this about, you know, we in the space community, the space cadets, we just think it's natural that everyone's going to support Spirit of Exploration and build the big rockets and go do the stuff. And that time, that mix doesn't exist anymore. What can we learn from this story to help us sell or deal with whatever's coming next with President Obama?
Well, first was the way we did Apollo was not sustainable. It wasn't sustainable in 1969 and 1970. We achieved a goal set to get to a particular place by a particular time. We did that and then quit and started over, basically, with the shuttle.
Right.
So I think it is time, and I think that's what President Obama proposed last February of 2010, to do a long-range program based on 21st-century technology that that is sustainable, that doesn't set specific hard deadlines as a national commitment. But sure, you need some kind of indication of schedule and destinations to guide what you're doing, but not something of the character of the Kennedy commitment to get to the moon before this decade is out.
Do we need to start thinking more about, which I think is where my opinion is beginning to go, more about space utilization than space exploration? We can still have a robust infrastructure in space, but our goal is to live and work up there to bring back good things to the planet rather than necessarily planting footprints at places we've never been before.
Well, eventually, for exploration to be, well, let's see, if we're going to build an infrastructure between the Earth and the Moon, or even just in low Earth orbit, it has to produce tangible benefits for society. We can't do it on excitement.
Right.
I think the reason to go explore is to find out whether there are resources other places in the solar system, on the lunar surface, on asteroids, eventually on Mars, that can sustain people that want to colonize, a bad word, that want to settle there, and whether they can do something of economic value so that you can create a space economy that goes beyond the immediate vicinity of Earth.
What about time to go figure out fusion and solar power satellites?
Well,
price of oil high enough yet?
It's getting there. I've seen a $4.99 premium gallon price, and for that matter, I was just in Europe last weekend, and the gas prices over there about $8 a gallon.
Oh my gosh! Look, well, hey, John, sorry, got to wrap it up here with that bad news about the price of oil, but. I want to thank you for being on. We're going to have you on again sometime real soon because we can keep talking forever, I have a feeling.
Okay, great to speak with you, too.
Thanks, John. We'll talk to you soon. We're going to take our final break, get back in touch with you with an update from Space Florida. Plus, we'll have our weekly launch forecast segment. This is Space Talk, brought to you by Space Florida. I'm Jim Behnke. You're listening to WMMB.
This is Space Talk with Jim Behnke.
That beat is almost enough to get me up to dance. Almost. Well, welcome back as we begin our final segment of today's edition of Space Talk, sponsored by Space Florida. Space Talk also brought to you today by the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex, where it's not too early to pick up your tickets to a pair of events now 1 month away. On May 5th will be the 50th anniversary celebration of America's first astronaut to fly in space, Alan Shepard. And then on May 7th, the annual U.S. Astronaut Hall of Fame induction ceremony will take place, this year honoring veteran shuttle astronauts Carl Bobko and Susan Helms. All the details online at kennedyspacecenter.com. Well, it's time to get our weekly update from our major sponsor, Space Florida. Joining us on the phone, as he always does more or less this time each week, the director of spaceport operations there at Space Florida, Patrick McCarthy. Pat, how are you today?
Doing just fine, Jim. How about you?
Good. Glad to have you on board. Hopefully not taking you out of the sun for too long here.
No, just a break in the yard work. That's okay by me.
That's good enough for you. Good. Well, we talked last week about the fact that you guys were having some guests in town from Great Britain, and I'm just wondering how that went.
Yeah, that was a pretty spectacular event. We had this United Kingdom trade mission in the area this past week, and through that we helped them, well, we think, forge some great new relationships between Florida companies and several UK companies that came over to visit. And I think these are going to result in some cooperative business agreements on a whole range of space-related technologies. They were really enthusiastic to be here and to meet Florida companies and to see the kinds of things we can do in the state. And I know they really love touring the Space Life Sciences Lab and getting out to the shuttle pad to see Endeavor. That was the highlight of their trip.
You know, I've always been convinced that you have to get people excited by space by bringing them out here and doing it one-on-one, one person at a time almost.
Absolutely right. That always works well, and we got them together with a lot of the CEOs and business development reps from several companies here in the state, and it was just great one-on-one relationship building. I think we're going to see a lot of new contracts grow out of this, and the trade mission is really going to result in some new businesses here in Florida.
Yeah, are these the kind of guys that would come in and fill the research park out there, or launch sites, or where would you put them?
It would certainly be great candidates for the exploration park out there next to KSC, because a lot of these companies develop different space technologies. For instance, we had the Surrey Satellite Technology folks, and they build small and medium-sized satellites, so obviously they'd be a great customer for the things that we launch from here. So that'll be the great new payloads. And other ones that develop things like special glass that goes on solar panels and just a whole range of different technologies. Mm-hmm. And yeah, they'd fit in very well out there.
Well, you know, Pat, I'm watching the news here out of Tallahassee too, and I wanted to ask you about this, especially because in another day, in another world, I wore a hat where I was on the governor's commission that actually originally formed Space Florida, and I'm watching the talk in Tallahassee about a potential reorganization of some of the state agencies and some talk that maybe Space Florida might be, I don't know what, not necessarily reorganized, but moved from one kind of branch to another. What are you hearing about that? What can you report about that?
Most I know, you know, we're doing the Senate's put out Bill 7202, which is called the Jobs Florida Bill, and it stands up in a new entity called the Jobs Florida Partnership, and that's sort of a consortium of several of the other business development and workforce kinds of organizations that exist in the state. And Space Florida, it looks like, the way the bill's written now, looks like we would retain our independent special district status. You know, we keep the same authority and powers and duties that we have in the current legislation, but it just moves us under a different reporting organization. Instead of the Office of Tourism, Trade, and Economic Development, we would report to this Jobs Florida Partnership.
Do you happen to know if Enterprise Florida would be moved?
I believe so. I haven't read all 720-some pages of the bill yet, but there's a lot of that
That kind of stuff.
That's not a kind of stuff in there, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and this is, just make it clear, this is my opinion now, but, you know, I was very concerned when we formed Space Florida that someone would come in and just muck up the works again and switch it all around. If Space Florida survives as its own organization, that doesn't really matter to me who much it reports to. The big thing that we tried to do as a commission in forming Space Florida was to set up the ability for Space Florida to take the lead in space-related economic development, working with, but not in place of, you know, the other folks like Enterprise Florida and Jobs Florida and these other organizations. And so if this is a way to streamline a budget and save some money, not so worried about it. If they start stripping powers and taking away your ability to do your job, then I'm going to start getting nervous about it. But it's interesting what you say, that it's working the way through the 700-page bill.
Something like that, and yeah. That's an interesting opinion. Of course, I couldn't possibly comment on that.
No, not at all. So sounds like it's a good time to get back to your yard work.
Yes, it is. Good time to escape while I can.
Okay, good. Pat, thanks for the update this week. I'm sure we'll talk to you again very soon.
All right, thanks, Jim.
All right, take care. There goes Pat McCarthy, Director of Spaceport Operations for Space Florida, giving us some news without actually trying to give us some news, which is just fine because he's that kind of a guy. Well, look, it's time for our weekly look at the launch forecast, which is brought to you by United Space Alliance, innovation you can trust, performance you can count on. Well, as we've been counting down here for several weeks now, the next launch from the Cape continues to be targeted for April 19th at 7:48 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. A really only about, what are we, 16 days away, 17 days away. It's getting close. Space Shuttle Endeavour's final mission to fly from Kennedy Space Center, pad 39A. Countdown preparation is going well. The big news there this week was that the six-member flight crew, as I'm sure a lot of you saw, were in town this week, led by Commander Mark Kelly. They were here for the traditional practice countdown, the terminal countdown demonstration test, the TCDT, an acronym I learned when I was very young, and I hope that it will continue. That took place yesterday. What happens there is a full dress rehearsal for the launch. They dress up in the orange suits. Go out to the pad. Just everything is just exactly like it is on launch day, except for the tanks aren't fueled with their propellant. And they get inside the spacecraft, shut the hatch, and go through a standard countdown, taking it all the way down to about, I think it's about 4 seconds when they abort the main engine board. And then they do an emergency egress, a practice at getting out of there as fast. They don't actually get to ride the slide buckets back, but in any case, it all went well. So that's the update for now. We look forward to that launch April 19th at 7:48. Well, let's wrap it up here. Next week, Alan Stern's going to join us, planetary scientist, talking about some interesting developments in the commercial space world. And I invite you to stay tuned for that. Space Talk, sponsored by Space Florida. And is a production of Mylas Solutions. George Medina is running the board today, my chief engineer for one day only here at Space Talk. Thanks to George filling in for Aaron, who's out on assignment. Up next on WMMB is the Home Mortgage Law Show, so please stay tuned for that. I'm Jim Bankey. We'll talk to you again real soon.